Everyone, John Wertheim here. It's this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. Hope everybody is well, safe, sane. If possible, you are home. This week, we have Joe Posnanski as our guest. It's a terrific conversation. Joe is one of America's finest sports writers, I would say, period. He's a longtime friend, longtime colleague at Sports Illustrated. He now writes for The Athletic. He has his own blog. He does the podcast. He is also the author of a recent biography of Harry Houdini I urge you to pick up. But beyond all that, Joe is a huge tennis fan, really knows his stuff, a real connoisseur. He also is admittedly, by his admission, partial to Novak Djokovic, which informs his writing. If you have a chance, read his dispatch, his recap of the 2019 Wimbledon final, and that comes through. So this is a great conversation. Joe recently did a piece for The Athletic ranking the top 100 baseball players of all time. So we talk about what goes into these inter-era comparisons that we all like so much, what makes them fun, what makes them problematic. We talk about the Hall of Fame. We talk about comparing eras. We talk about his backhand. Just a good conversation with a good guy. So here's Joe.
Part of what inspired this, I always forget, you know, I think like most people, I associate you first and foremost with baseball, but I always forget you are you're a hardcore tennis guy as well.
I'm a hardcore tennis guy. Yeah, I play, I write, I think about it all the time. I've spent, I would imagine, I don't want to put a percentage on it, but if I had to, 24% of my time in isolation watching old YouTube tennis videos, I think. Pretty much tennis all the time.
That's by my math, that's about 6 hours. What's the best? Give us some highlights.
Well, what I tended to do is just go down rabbit holes. So I had like this week or two period where I was just watching old Yvonne Lendl tennis. I had a McEnroe, of course, like everybody had a McEnroe stretch of time where I was watching all sorts of old McEnroe videos. I had a Steffi Graf period where I was watching old Steffi. So I don't know why I started going down. I started thinking, you know, I write so much, and, you know, you write way more about it than I do, but I write quite a bit about, you know, the greatest ever and focusing on the big three that play today. And I just kind of wanted to go back and look at some of these old players and that I remember from when I was a kid, but just see how different the game was then and how, you know, try to imagine even somebody as recently as Sampras or Agassi playing in today's game. And I have to tell you, the more tennis I watch, the harder it is to imagine those people in today's game.
And that's because of what?
I guess because of the equipment, but they just played. I mean, Sampras would serve and volley first, second serve, you know? I mean, he just was constantly coming in and you just, it's very difficult to imagine him serve and volleying, Rafael Nadal
right.
or just about anybody. I mean, you look at a guy like Del Potro, you know, trying to serve and volley to his forehand would be, you know, suicide. But I think about how different the game was because of the equipment. So it's very difficult. I don't know what John McEnroe would do in today's game. I mean, I assume he would adjust and all of that, but I just, you know, I'm trying to think of him serving and volleying to Djokovic and just absolutely just watching the ball go by him every single time. I mean, it's just a different game.
I should back up and say, you know, some of the reasons I'm glad we're able to do this for a variety of reasons. A, you're among the titans of this profession. B, you are, I like that you're tennis bona fides are coming out in your finest, but also you just got done ranking 100 baseball players. So this exercise of inter-era comparisons and accounting for things like equipment and training is fresh on your mind. And I don't want to spoil it, but you ended up with your number one player was not someone the majority of your readers will have ever seen play.
That's right.
I don't know. I mean, baseball is not tennis, but how do you go about this exercise? What do you think is the value of this exercise? As we all get enticed by this GOAT conversation, which of course will never yield a satisfactory answer to anyone, give us some tips most fundamentally on how to approach this.
Well, it's funny because I have thought long and hard about doing a 100 greatest tennis players thing just because I love the sport so much. But to me, if I did it, I would have to put men and women together, and it would just be a whole different kind of exercise. You wouldn't really, you'd almost be talking about the impact on the sport and that kind of thing, much more than in baseball, where for some reason in baseball, people just want to believe that the game hasn't really changed and the players haven't really changed. And so you could take Cy Young or Walter Johnson out of dead ball and they could come in and you know pitch to Albert Pujols or Mike Trout. I mean, it's just different because I think specifically of tennis and I think specifically of you know Bill Tilden or you know somebody of that era who was dominant. I mean, you can't be more dominant than Tilden was in his time, and yet nobody would really even try to think of him facing, you know, Roger Federer. It's just the sport has changed so much. So I think it's more of a challenge in tennis, not necessarily because the sport has changed more than baseball, because baseball has changed much, much, much more than people want to acknowledge. It's the fact that people have this sort of dream about tennis, about baseball, that it's timeless and it right. stays the same. While everybody in tennis knows that the equipment that, you know, Roger Federer was using at the beginning of his career is significantly different than the rackets and training and things that he's doing at the end of his career. The game just changes that rapidly.
What about the, how much do you put into the physique of the players? I would say when Tracy Austin won the US Open, I think she weighed 89 pounds. most players, male and female, that's about one leg. How do we account for that?
Well, yeah, you have to, and it's really hard to account. I remember, and I did go back and watch I think it was the Tracy Austin, Chris Evert. It was U.S. Open final, I think. Mm-hmm. But I remember watching a U.S. Open final that Chris Evert was broadcasting, and they showed a little bit of that match. Like they just like said, oh, hey, Chrissy, let's go back and watch when you were playing. And they showed a little match and she said the funniest thing. She's like, wow, we really weren't hitting it very hard, were we? I mean, it was like watching Pong, you know, it was just like, bing, bing. It was so slow. You can't take 89 pound Chris Evert or Tracy Austin. I mean, Chris was a little bit, you know, more physical, but you can't take those players out and then have them, you know, transform them and have them play Serena. It wouldn't even look, you know, like something that could happen. Obviously, if Tracy Austin was playing in today's game, her genius for the game doesn't change. So Tracy Austin plays today, she's a different player. She trains differently. Right. She hits the ball way harder. She's using the equipment. So I think it's harder to do that, but you're right. I mean, I think the biggest difference when one of my favorite things to do in general is just watch Djokovic highlights, you know, just watch him.
That's your guy. We need to acknowledge that, right? You're just,
he is my
guy.
He is my favorite. Okay. He is my guy. Love and look, but it's so fun that, and I think that's part of the thing that I love about tennis is I love Nadal and I love Federer. I don't dislike anybody in the top players. I mean, I think it was different when it was Connors and McEnroe and Borg. You know, you picked a favorite, you rooted against the others. I mean, what's to root against any of those three? I mean, they're and throw Andy Murray in there and throw Wawrinka in there. They're all joyous in so many ways. But Djokovic is my guy, and the thing that I love watching Djokovic is how much court he covers. It's not comparable. It's just, it's, you know, the Ivan Lendl was the fittest player of his day and got to a lot of balls. And, you know, and McEnroe was obviously physically very gifted, even if he didn't necessarily work out too hard. And Agassi was the same way, you know, physically gifted, didn't work out that hard necessarily. I mean, they couldn't get to balls that this guy can get to. I mean, it's just a different thing. You have to hit however many winners you have to hit to beat Djokovic. Those guys, certainly with the equipment they were using, they never could have gotten him off the court, ever. There's no possibility for hitting the ball at a good enough angle or hard enough to beat Djokovic without, you know, modern equipment and being physically, you know, dominant the way the players are today. I mean, it's just a different level, I think.
What's your definition of great? I mean, I feel like it's part of the great fun of this, but part of the fundamental problem of this whole discussion, we haven't even agreed on a definition, and we have this, to me, this sort of hollow, ill-fitting, frustrating word of greatest. How do you define that?
It's a great point, John. When you talk about it, what do people end up doing? They end up talking about who won the most Grand Slams, right? I mean, it just comes down to some sort of simple number, you know. And I think it's that way in golf too with Tiger. Tiger has to pass Jack Nicklaus on most majors to be considered the greatest. But even Jack Nicklaus will tell you he wasn't as good a player as Tiger Woods in his prime. So what is greatest? I mean, I think you look at those three. I mean, I think the conversation really does. You have to start with those three just because of the length of time that they were so great and the fact the game is so different now. And it's not to knock Rod Laver or Bjorn Borg or any of those guys. It's just different. And I think when you start with those three, how do you even define greatness among them? I mean, there's no question that Rafael Nadal is the greatest clay court player who's ever lived. I mean, it's like his surface he owns that. So how are you going to say anybody else is the greatest player when, if you played him on clay, Nadal would be the favorite and would likely win? I mean, it's so that's different. But then, did anybody really change sort of the level of the game the way Federer did? I mean, he came along at a time where number one was being passed around from player to player, and it was, you know, such a different, you know, everybody was sort of trying to figure out after Sampras and Agassi what was next, and and then this guy's, you know, the one of the two or three best players and often the best players for the next 20 years. I mean, it's lunacy. And then, you know, my feelings about Djokovic, I just think he's taken it one more level up. So, yeah, you define greatness basically by the way I look at it is sort of the same way I looked at the Baseball 100 and the way people have thought about that. You pick the player that you want to be the greatest, and then you just define it around him. That's how you do it.
You just build your argument backwards. No, but exactly. I mean, I feel like that's what people do with, you know, should we care about personal disposition? And the Federer fans say, yes, absolutely, credit to the sport. Look at Roger's philanthropy, and he's a gentleman, and he doesn't get fined. I mean, I feel like these goalposts move. But let me – I mean, actually, you know what? Let's stay on that. You mentioned Bill Tilden, who you know, perhaps the best player of the first half of the 20th century. Also, there were, you know, corrupting minors, morals charges.
Sure.
Do we care about constitution and disposition and these mushy sort of good guy and good woman credit to the game citizenship award type category?
Well, do we care? I mean, I guess it depends on what you're trying to define, right? I mean, that sort of gets back to your question, what is greatness? I mean, if somebody said to me, look, nobody has done more for the sport than Roger Federer, right? If somebody says to me that he took a sport that was sort of scattered about and not only played at you know, a level that had never been seen before, not only, you know, lasted longer than anybody else, but also his philanthropy and also his credit to the sport. He brought a class to tennis that is you know, a huge part of the sport's popularity in the world today. I couldn't argue with that, but I could say, well, look, Rafael Nadal has brought incredible class to the sport too, and is just a, you know, is just a model of sportsmanship and comportment and you know, has brought a hunger and energy to the game that is completely unique. And so then you make that argument, then you have my guy, and yeah, he's, you know, he's feisty, and he's not always held it together on the court and all those sorts of things. But you look at Djokovic, look at that story, look at that guy, where he came from and how he developed into into this extraordinary player, and then walking into a world of tennis that seemed closed. I mean, it was Federer and Nadal, and people still, you know, many people still wanted to be Federer and Nadal, and he came in and absolutely bullied his way not only to their level but to the next level, and so. You know, it's I don't know how you do it. I think everybody's going to do it their own way. I think I love Serena. I think Serena has done more for tennis. Well, you know, I think it's at the level of Federer what she's done for tennis. You know, but Serena's not always been easy, and you know, she certainly has had her moments on the court. And for me, that doesn't influence how I feel about their greatness. I think that it's a little similar in that way to baseball, that when I looked at the Baseball 100, you know, yeah, I took into account what they were like off the court and off the field and wrote about all of that. But, you know, the fact that Babe Ruth was, you know, he was a womanizing drunk. The fact Ty Cobb was a really difficult character. Yeah, it impacts how you feel about them, but it doesn't change their place in the game and their role in building baseball.
I feel like this pace of change is something that we, you know, we talk about pace of play, but this pace of change, we talk about dead ball pitchers pitching to Mike Trout, but nobody watches baseball from the 80s and says, boy, it's absurd to think that they would ever be able to, you know, hit Max Scherzer. It's really remarkable to think about, you know, even I can't believe I'm even saying, but you know, the Steffi Graf slice to the middle of the court and what Serena would do with that. It sounds almost sacrilegious to say this, but do you think it's more than equipment? I mean, what do you have you thought about why it is that we look at this and laugh?
Yeah, no, I have. And I think you're 100% right. Steffi Graf's slice was exactly what struck me. I mean, it was definitely a penetrating slice, and for the time and for the equipment people were using, it was lethal, right? I mean, it was absolutely lethal. She moved better than anybody on the court, and it was, you know, then of course had that dominant forehand and serve and was, you know, was just a great, great player for that equipment in that time. But yeah, you can't hit backhand slices every time in today's game. You can't. Right. I mean, you just see the power. You talk about Serena at the very top of the game, but all of these young players just come out crushing the ball. They just absolutely crush power on both sides. I mean, and most of them, it feels like, especially when they're younger, it's the backhand that is the stronger wing for some of these terrific young players. And you're telling me you're going to go backhand to backhand with the players today with a slice like that? You're just not. Mm. I just don't. And I should say, if Steffi Graf was playing today, I don't think she would hit that slice. I think she would just be different. So do I think it's the equipment? I think the equipment influenced the game in so many more ways than I talk about or think about. I mean, it influenced the game in that you can see how much slower the ball is moving. It influenced the game that how different movement was because you just didn't have to chase down, you know, the sorts of power that you do today. But I think it also influenced the game in simply the way you played, the way you played with that equipment. It's funny because what if we reversed it? What if we took it backward? Let's put Rafael Nadal in the day of wood rackets. He can't hit these shots. You know, he's not going to hit these incredible top spin shots from both wings with a wood racket. He'd break the racket.
He'd break his head. Yeah.
Right.
Break his wrist.
And his wrist, exactly. I mean, part of me is always one. I think you and I have actually talked about this in the past, that I wish they would play one wood racket tournament a year.
Yeah. Let's see. Exactly.
It would be so fun to see what these guys would do. I still think the best would be the best,
right?
But they,
right.
Their style would be so different. So I think that equipment is the big factor. But I also think that you know, when people talk about evolution of any sport, I think once people see, like in basketball, Steph Curry comes out and is making, you know, 40-foot shots routinely, right? 35, 40-foot shots. And then a whole next generation comes and they can all make 40-foot shots because he invented that. He invented that in their minds, in their imaginations. And so I think that, you know, when you see a Pete Sampras, that changes the way people serve, and you see an Andre Agassi, and that changes the way people return. Then you see Federer and Nadal and Djokovic, and, you know, the new players come along, they have to top this level. So I think some of it is racket, but I think some of it is just the years progressing.
You want my data free, completely intuitive theory on this? I think it's also hard to overlook the role of money, and that Serena Williams has never had to, you know, in the last 20 years, she's not had to wait for a rental car, and she hasn't had to go through security at the airport. And if she gains 2 pounds, she can hire a nutritionist. And the top players have not only have access to so many career enhancing services that Rod Laver and even Pete Sampras didn't. I think they also are able to avoid some of the drags. You know, it's a big difference when you can pick your own spots, and when you finally have to get from Indian Wells to Miami, you take your Gulfstream that leaves when you want to leave. I think that the, you know, abstract wealth of oligarchs of the top, you know, select group of a half dozen players is a big role in their longevity, and with longevity comes more and more numbers. But that is just a pet theory.
I love that theory, and I would tend to agree with it. I think that you look at different, you know, I think about Martina. You know, I mean, I think that Martina had her case. You know, Steffi came along, but I think Martina had her case while she was playing as the greatest player ever, right?
Right.
And still, you can make that argument, you know, when comparing apples to apples and all that. But what a different world. She played, like, team tennis. I remember her playing in Cleveland for money. Like,
right.
she needed the money. So she's playing, like, and you know, at the Cleveland you know, outdoor courts, you know, somewhere just to get by. So yeah, I think it's a completely different time. And I think the point on specifically to longevity is huge. I mean, right. The whole game, the whole notion of the game has changed, right? We used to think 32 was when it ended, you know, like, oh boy.
Yeah, 32, you're bridging over to the CEO, you know, a couple more years and you can start to make money on the seniors tour.
Exactly. And now, you know, you're like, oh, look, Djokovic is only 32. He has, what, 6 more years?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
It's just a different thing. Exactly. It really is different.
What, you know, here's another baseball one for you. Do you vote for Hall of Fame?
I do.
I'm not sure how you're aware of some of the controversy with tennis's Hall of Fame, which I don't think is particularly controversial. But can you give people a sense of the standards, baseball versus tennis?
Yeah, well, tennis, and I think that when you're talking about some of the controversy, you're talking about some of the changes, right? I mean, are they talking about doing something?
I think it's more just the threshold. I mean, in tennis, it's gotten to the point where basically you have a pretty good career, you stay out of prison, you win a major, and you're in the conversation. I mean, Michael Steek might be a lovely guy, but, I mean, to me, Michael Steek is a 280 hitter.
Right.
Great career. You don't begrudge the guy anything, but I would say the standards in tennis are considerably lower than other sports. But I wonder, as someone who votes for baseball, and you've seen sort of what the threshold is for that sport, if you is one preferable to the other, Big Ten, Small Ten, where do you stand on all this?
Well, I'm a Big Ten baseball guy, but here's what I think is different about tennis, and this is also true about golf, by the way, because this has also been a big thing in golf. Is Fred Couples really a Hall of Famer? He won one major, whatever, but if he's a major, then is Davis Love a Hall of Famer? You know, and so that's the old tennis thing, and I think golf. I mean, I think that's the old golf thing, and I think tennis. It's the problem with tennis and the Hall of Fame is the same problem that golf has compared to baseball, which is every year in baseball, you would expect there to be 10 to 15 players who are active players who are going to go to the Hall of Fame someday. That's just sort of how the thing plays out. I mean, it's not always true. Sometimes there are more, but, you know, 10 to 15 players or so,
right,
simply because of the way the years are going on. Well, nobody thinks there are 10 or 15 tennis players right now playing who belong or are going to go to the Hall of Fame or should go to the Hall of Fame, especially on the men's side where you know there are three guys have dominated the sport like never before. But yeah, you have to keep going, right? You have to, you can't just like stop putting people. I remember I was saying to somebody like, oh, it would really be cool if Federer and Nadal would go into the Hall of Fame together. And the person who runs the Hall of Fame was saying to me, no, you never do that. I mean, you got to spread that out. You can't waste it in 1 year. And you know, tennis does put in a few people each year and you just run out pretty quickly when you do that. I mean, I think it's hard. I would prefer like a tight tennis Hall of Fame where you're not just putting anybody who's number one in the world or has won, you know, a major or, you know, I mean, I would prefer it being like this higher level, but you know, I have a really good friend here who is a tennis pro and we just talk tennis all the time and I'll just come up and he'll just say something like, all right, Stan Wawrinka, Hall of Famer. And I'm like, by the standards of today, it's his first ballot.
Exactly. You talk about better Nadal. I'm worried about this year's Hall of Fame class, Serena Williams and Jelena Jankovic. And you sort of have these two players who have wildly different resumes, both ending up in the same place. Let me, in our few minutes remaining, let me ask you a magic question. You wrote a book about Houdini that I actually just saw. I just saw reviewed in the New Yorker like last week.
Maybe
last month.
Cool.
I don't know. I'm behind on my New Yorkers, but not as far as they are behind on their books. I did not know you were a magic guy. And B, inevitably, magic is a theme that comes up a lot in tennis. And I wondered if is it too big a stretch to equate the two? But first and foremost, how'd you get into Houdini?
Well, getting into Houdini was very – I do like magic. I mean, I always – have. And my dad was, used to perform, he would do magic tricks for me when I was young and always liked it. And for Houdini, it was not specifically magic and it was not specifically Houdini. I wanted to do a story about wonder and how, how we've sort of lost it a little bit in the world today. Right. And how this guy still creates it and people still feel wonder about a guy who performed 100 years ago. And how did that happen? What did he do? What real magic did this guy have that he's still on everybody knows, you know, you could go into a second grade class and say Houdini and they know exactly who you're talking about. And there's just really very, very few people from 100 years ago that's true of, you know? And so that was sort of the focus for me, but it is interesting because I have thought a lot about it in sports and particularly in tennis. I think everybody I know in the tennis world loved the David Foster Wallace piece on Federer, right? Federer and
religious experience,
the experience, yeah. So religious experience of Federer. And I think it was because he was really writing about magic. He was writing about, you know, he was a tennis player himself and played at a pretty high level. But even for a guy like him, watching Federer do some of the absurd things that he does on the court, and there are very few people, because one of the other things that I've done while in isolation is like just type in greatest tennis shots into YouTube just watch. And he's got a huge bulk of them. Although I will say for my guy, Djokovic has a whole bunch of them too.
Really? You know,
I think Djokovic sometimes gets called mechanical or doesn't.
He's a clinician. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. But there's magic in that guy. If you see like anytime somebody drop shots him, he comes up with the craziest angles and shots and I mean,
the drop shot off the drop shot is one of the great great Djokovic plays.
He's really really fun. But yeah, I think what magic is when you see something, you go, How'd he do it? How'd she do it? That to me is the very essence of magic, is that thing that pops into your head and it sort of opens up the world a little bit. And I think, like, when I see that in football, right, you see a running back make a play like that, or I see it in golf where somebody hits some sort of crazy shot, it's cool. But because I'm a tennis player, you know, so-called, and because I love the sport so much, I don't know that anything moves me the same way that a magical right. tennis shot does. I just seeing somebody run down a ball that you just don't think there's any possibility, and then hit a winner off that, which is, you know, the Federer thing. It's extraordinary. It's just, I think there's nothing like it. It's why I think the sport, you know, and worldwide, of course, it's extraordinarily popular, but I think in the US its popularity is, you know, under much discussion, but I can't see how somebody can't watch tennis and just get that feeling of just what that was absolutely remarkable.
I'm going to take this in a crazy direction. You ready to?
Yes. I am, John.
I'm listening to you describe this, and I'm listening to you talk about sort of wonder and misdirection and capacity for awe. How are you? If I told you 90 days ago that in the middle of April we're all going to be locked in our homes and financial markets were going to be going off a cliff, and we were uncertain, there wasn't going to be any sports on TV, and we were uncertain when we were going to go back. How are you experiencing? I was going to make this a corona-free podcast, but I'm listening to you describe magic, and I'm seeing some Venn diagram overlap here. If wonder and capacity for awe has been on your mind lately, how are you experiencing this?
Yeah, well, it's...
didn't anticipate going here, but...
No. I don't know that I'm experiencing it any, you know, with any more, you know, a sense of understanding than anybody else, right? I mean, we're all in this thing together. The thing that I find incredible about the time that we're in is just that. You know, we've been a country that has been, and I'm not talking politically or anything like that, but from a pure pop culture standpoint, we've divided, right? We all watch what we want to watch. We all do what we want to do. It's like, you know, the whole thing that used to bring the country together, other than the Super Bowl and you know, maybe a few other award shows or whatever, that it doesn't do that anymore. We just don't come together in that way, because we can just sit there and watch, you know, old John McEnroe YouTube videos. We don't have to do anything else, right? And one of the thoughts that I have had about this, you know, when you talk about awe, is we're all kind of doing the same thing now. I mean, yeah, we're watching different stuff, and we're all, you know, figuring out what, you know, other than Tiger King, I guess everybody's watching. I'm not watching it, but everybody else is. But we're all in this thing together. Like, we're all, like, don't know when we're going to get our next haircut. We all are scared for ourselves or for family members or both. And we're all in our houses and trying to figure out how much toilet paper we have left. And I mean, it's, you know, I'm certainly not naive or, you know, I'm not looking at this with any kind of rose colored glasses. It's a terrible tragedy what's happening around us. And, you know, whether it's job losses, whether it's the pain or whether it's just the hardcore, deaths and all of that. I mean, it's that we're going through something that's horrible, but at the same time, we are doing this together. Mm-hmm. And even though we're all in our own homes and we don't see anybody except through Zoom, you know, I've thought a lot about that. I've thought a lot about, you know, that there are so many other, for me, the thing I miss most just in my own personal sort of daily life is tennis. I've not been out to play. Well, I mean, it's the one bit of exercise I do. It's the one thing that I, you know, and I would try before this all happened, I was going out 4 or 5 times a week if I could to go out and play tennis. And, and I haven't played tennis in a month. And I hear from all of my tennis buddies and they're all like, you know, hey, when are we going to get out on the court again? And, And I just think that we're all experiencing this. So I don't know, you know, how you bring awe into this kind of world, because it's so daunting. But I do feel like we are, you know, not to say anything more about the Baseball 100, but, you know, I started ranking these baseball players in December and counted down from 100 to 1. And the first, you know, 75, 80 of them were before this all hit. And, you know, it was definitely, you know, hugely popular, and people had a lot of opinions, and it was great. But once all this hit, that suddenly, for so many people, seemed to take on a whole different meaning, you know, right. Because there was no baseball, there were no sports, and this was sort of one thing that was still going on. And I'm very humbled by that. I mean, the notes and letters and emails that I would get from people about it was very humbling, and I thought, yeah, I mean, that sort of gets back to the heart of it, which is where I just think that there's not much good we can take from any of this. But one thing that I think that is good is I think that we are really doing this together.
I was going to ask you how your tennis list, what that would look like, but I don't want to do that because I want you to do tennis now. You could do like 50. Well, I don't know if we need 100. I don't know if we need, you know, verses and verse on Bunny Austin and you can start in about 1940. How do we get you to do tennis though?
I should. Well, I was on a podcast not that long ago, and it was a tennis podcast. And I was, we were talking about tennis, and I said, you know, they said, do you have a dream? Like, do you have a writer's dream? I mean, you know, been lucky enough, as have you, you know, we worked together at Sports Illustrated. I mean, the greatest place in the world, and have done so many cool things, you know, which is great. And I said, you know what I would love to do is I would love for, nobody would ever pay me to do this, but I would love to spend 1 year doing nothing but tennis. Literally, just doing, like, literally covering tennis.
How do we make that happen?
I don't think that could happen, but I would love to do that. So my kids are almost out of the house. My older one is going to college next year, and my younger one is a freshman. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, God, just one, I would love to do that, where I'm just out writing about tennis and playing tennis and just living a tennis life. So that top 50 would be like a perfect way to do that.
I got to tell you, this isn't saying like I want to win Wimbledon one day. This sounds utterly doable.
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't know that world exists where somebody would do that for me. But I will say, if I did a top 50, the thing that would be the hardest part is when to start. And you just said it on the thing, because I almost would want to do a top 50 where you don't go before Rod Laver, right? Like, I think that Rod Laver sort of creates a whole new, but you don't want to do it just open era, because that leaves out so many great stories.
Right.
So I think you'd almost have to go back to the beginning, wouldn't you?
I guess. I mean, it's sort of, I feel like in tennis especially, and well, we've talked about this, but I feel like tennis is so, it ends up being very prejudiced against players from past eras. I don't think you would end up with someone who played in the 1960s as your winner in tennis, but, and it's from, you know, it's funny because we always say so little in tennis has changed. In the last 100 years, the tiebreaker is the great change. That's sort of the company line. And yet, you can't find me a sport that looks less like it did 20 years ago. I mean, we've talked about this before, but it's funny that tennis is so change resistant, and yet it looks utterly different from sort of one generation to the next, never mind the sport that was being played 50, 60 years ago, or 100
years ago. There's one other part of that, by the way, that we have not talked about that I think we should, because I'm really curious your opinion on this. The surfaces have changed, right? I mean, Wimbledon is not Wimbledon anymore. Wimbledon is not, or it's better Wimbledon.
No, you're right.
The rallies are amazing now.
Right.
But there were no rallies then. There were no rallies in the 90s, and there were no – Goran Ivanišević never hit a second shot. I mean, it was just a completely different surface. And I do wonder, you talk about how things have changed. I mean, if we had that lightning fast, Wimbledon, I don't know.
Would Djokovic, yeah, exactly.
I don't know. It's a really good question.
Kevin Anderson, your Wimbledon champion. all right, we need to do a second one of these. That's my takeaway from all this.
Yes, definitely. I'm always ready.
This was great. We will link the top 100. We will link your book. I also want to link the Lin-Manuel Miranda piece, which is a personal favorite. This was great, though. I really appreciate this.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
That was fun. That was good fun. All right. Stay safe. Stay home. We're going to see you on the tennis circuit when your daughter goes off to college.
I'm ready. I am ready, man.
All right. Thanks to our guest, Joe Posnanski. That was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that. We will have him back. Thanks, as always, to our super producer, Jamie Lasanti, who I admit, I miss being across the table from Jamie. Thanks to all of you for listening. We tried to make this a corona-free podcast and just think about something else for half an hour, and then I had to bring it up there in the end. But anyway, hope you enjoyed that conversation. That was a lot of fun with Joe. We will have a new guest next week. Subscribe, leave a review. It all helps. We have a new Sports Illustrated podcast coming up that I'll tell you about more next week. We will have a new guest next week. You can continue to watch Tennis Channel Live, noon Eastern, every day, where we have a fun whip-around show that Steve Weissman hosts. Hey, as long as we're plugging. 60 Minutes is on CBS, 7 p.m. every Sunday. And otherwise, hope everybody's well. Hope everyone is, again, staying safe, staying sane. This will be over soon enough, but until then, we'll keep doing our thing. Thanks, everyone. Have a good week.